of technical problems this morning. And so we've been struggling for the last several minutes here, but it looks like it's all coming together. Ben and I have been, of course, ruminating about the past and how different things were and how things are changing and what the future will be, as preachers often do when they get together. And we were talking just this morning about our technological revolution. And you talk about a love-hate relationship. If I was to ever meet Bill Gates, I don't know if I would kiss him or strangle him. But it certainly has enhanced the speed at which we could study our Bibles. And I have become quite the user of PowerPoint and all of that. You know, I think it's also helped our presentations. But when it doesn't work, it works not spectacularly. That's what I've discovered the hard way. Good to see everybody, of course. I have been known to many of you for quite a few years, spent most of my life up here in Washington State. The last 6.5 years, my wife Dawn and I have been down in Eugene, Oregon, and loving the congregation down there. If you visit at Coburg Road, as some have, and I've seen you down there. But it's good for me to be back home. This will forever and always be home, the state of Washington for us. So most of it was spent up in Snohomish County. Good to be among people who truly are my people at the core. Both, you know, from the physical sense of the state, but certainly because we are brothers and sisters in Christ, we are part of a very common family. I have a tremendous amount of material, so hopefully we'll have more time to get to meet throughout the next few days, but I'm going to plunge very directly into the study this morning. You will note as I go through my lessons, I've made a total of 4 trips and planning a 5th one to Israel, and so I often will have a title slide. I won't always explain that after this morning's class, but you'll notice there'll be a descriptive explanation at the bottom of just the title slides, which I leave up as we're getting ready for me to be actually preaching. So this is a view you don't see very often over all of northern Galilee from the hillside that is immediately above Caesarea Philippi. Who do men say that I am? And Jesus, you know, build my church, gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. That took place just barely out of sight, just below that hill that's in the foreground and those ruins that you see in the foreground there. So they'll be unrelated to the lessons in this particular series, but you'll be getting little snippets of what it was like to be in that promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. One of those things that, of course, Ben and I have been discussing quite a bit is what has been notoriously well known in the United States, an extremely steep decline in interest in all things biblical, in all things that are related to the God of heaven, our Creator, that which is loosely referred to as Christianity and even more properly defined among us, is watching the numbers just precipitously fall over the course of only really the last 20 to 30 years. The United States of America, we have enjoyed for centuries, for the first 2 full centuries at least, a very steady conviction, high numbers of people, our culture as a continental nation, believed in the God of the Bible. And then about 20 to 30 years ago, that percentage just fell off the edge of the cliff. So the actual numbers are not important there. This starts at 52. That's the year I was born and ends in 2012. So it's 6 years older, 6 years, past since this thing was created. But it only got worse. In the United States of America, it is now no longer a majority that really have anything to do with any church or any real conviction in the God of heaven. And in fact, this one, which sees the bar going up very steeply, is a survey. This one's even a bit older. It ended in 2010. Shows from 1970 to 2010, the percentage of adult Americans with no religious affiliation whatsoever. Now, it's gone for another 8 years worse, of course, but even then, we were at 18% who had nothing whatsoever to do with any kind of a religion. And so churches of Christ are in this culture and in this society watching their numbers decline very, very rapidly. And it's been a major concern for us for a couple of decades now. This, though, is just the fact. And there's nothing new under the sun, is there? The fact of the matter is that the way has always been straight and narrow, and few there are who find it. We're never going to be in the majority as God's people anyhow. It is true that the gospel can be in season or out of season. And most of us would agree that we've watched it getting further out of season throughout the course of our lives. Used to be much easier to interest people in a home Bible study. Used to be much easier to have people attend meetings from out of the community, and they could last for weeks on end. None of those things are so any longer. And I guess maybe the whole theme of our time together this week would be this. So what? It's always been this way. So, yes, it might be a little more difficult, the fields that we are tilling and working now. Well, no matter, they've been worse. They've been better. We are called to our service before our God in our time and in our place, and it doesn't matter whether the gospel's in season or out of season. We are to be prepared for every eventuality. We are to be well-learned in the Scriptures, we are to be masters of those Scriptures, and we are to be able to handle any objection, every form and kind and type of objection should not be something that is going to thwart us or discourage us, cause us, you know, to just give up. So I'm going to start at square one this morning, because in this series, what is, you know, the genesis behind it in my mind is that, yes, it is more difficult now in America than it has been in the past, because Ben and I have enjoyed an awful long period of time where really the only battle we had was to point out, you know, I'm sorry, we love you, but there aren't any Baptists in the Bible. There aren't any Catholics in the Bible. There aren't any Presbyterians, there aren't any Methodists, there aren't any Mormons. This thing called hyphenated Christianity, join the church of your choice, we're all going to heaven on different roads, doesn't matter, God doesn't care what you believe or practice. You know, that was the ethic, and all we had to do was help people who already believed in God, who already respected the Bible, who had some interest in truth. We just had to show them where all these other counterfeit groups had made their mistakes. Here's a better way. It follows the Bible pattern more clearly. That's not the case anymore. Just this morning I told Ben that it was in the last half of the 1970s, the first time that I was working with a young man. He was in his 20s, I guess, university student. They were over in the U District in Seattle for this Bible study. In the course of the Bible study, I said to him just the offhand statement, well, I guess that, whatever it was we were talking about, has been going on since Adam and Eve. And he looked at me in all seriousness and he said, who are they? Not a clue. Who were Adam and Eve? And it's because of men like this that we've come to this place here in the United States. That man is Christopher Hitchens. I just want to talk about the last decade and three of the big leaders of the anti-God movement who have been so enormously successful that we are now being forced to do studies and prepare people to believe in God first. Then we'll open our Bibles and show you what it is that you're to believe about God. Christopher Hitchens in 2007 came out with a runaway bestseller. The book was entitled, God is Not Great. It's subtitled, How Religion Poisons Everything. Well, it's not like, you know, he had low expectations of what he was trying to accomplish. He wanted to turn people, and was rather successful, entirely away from every religion that could be imagined. So in 2007, this runaway bestseller was written by this man. This postscript I've composed myself, but Hitchens, who left his pregnant wife while she was pregnant with their second child for another woman, ran off to commit adultery and abandoned the child and the wife, was in the process of dying from esophageal cancer when he was on tours around the nation and being feted on all the talk shows and all the rest of that, just enormously popular. And he said then that using cigarettes and alcohol makes you a candidate for the disease. Ha ha, very proud, bragging about the whole thing. He also bragged that his long-time daily intake of alcohol was enough, this is another of his quotes, to kill or stun the average mule. And, that's an end quote, then he welcomes being attacked as a drinker because, begin quote, I always think it's a sign of victory when they move on to the ad hominem, end quote. Now I'm going to oblige him for just a moment this morning. He was trying in that facetious way to avoid being, you know, the recipient of an ad hominem argument. Ad hominem. Yes, fancy Latin term that just means against the man, toward the man, or to the man. The idea is, we've come to think of it as, you're avoiding the argumentation, you're avoiding the thrust of my reason, you're demonstrating you can't handle what it is that I'm trying to teach you, because now you're just going to attack me. I'm an alcoholic, so I must be wrong. Well, he's dodging the major issue here, though. The issue is whether or not we should follow your philosophy. If we should become disciples of your way of living. Jesus used the ad hominem argument when he taught that you can tell a tree by its fruits. The ad hominem argument is to look at the man, and if your immediate response is disgust, well then, his rationale, his thinking, his brilliance, his ideas, the end result is drunken adultery and then death at the hands of things that you know you shouldn't be doing, but you choose to do anyway. So, let me see if I get this right, Mr. Hitchens. The alcoholic adulterer dies young, he's gone now, from the stuff he drank and smoked, but he wants me to think that religion is the poison that we need to worry about, and that he has the superior intellect in argumentation. Pardon me for thinking not. Now, we'll spend some time thinking about his reason and his argumentation. But brethren, if this is what you want to become, then truly you won't fit in among us. We think these behaviors are a bad idea. You don't have to be a Bible believer to figure that out. So he kind of puzzles me, this guy who was so enormously popular, because it doesn't add up that you would want to live the life that is the direct result of his philosophy. The second guy that came along a year later in 2008 was Richard Dawkins. He wrote this book called The God Delusion. I've read both of them. He continues this tradition, and this man admits, though, his own helplessness. I got to give him a little bit, you know, of kudos, I suppose, above Hitchens, who is just crass and base and revolting. This man at least is intelligent and seems to live, you know, a little higher standard than animal. And this man, though, in his book, he said, quote, God, though not technically disprovable, is very, very improbable indeed. I want you to think about that statement for just a minute. It took him three chapters and 109 pages to get to the point where he said, I can't prove there's no God, though that's his conviction, what he's spreading, just like Hitchens. But he says, God is very, very improbable. Oh boy, that changes my mind. How about this? Listen carefully, everybody. God is very, very, very probable. Now, if I use three varies instead of two, is my argumentation stronger? Will you believe me now? Because I can string more varies together than he does. I can understand Dawkins. He's not smarter than me or you or anybody else. I can understand his argumentation, and he's right. He has set out to prove something that is impossible. He has set out to try and argue that there is no God for sure. And that can't be done. What that says then, brethren, is that you and I occupy the high ground. You and I occupy the high ground in that people generally will want to live more like us than Hitchens. And people would like a bit more than just a very, very improbable. So, let's take one more step. Let's go to the smartest guy that has ever lived in our generation. How many of you have ever seen one episode of The Big Bang Theory? I've seen them all. Go ahead and admit it. It's a funny show. Okay? So you heard about Stephen Hawking. He's appeared on the show. He is the reigning scientist. That sitcom is about people who have a lot of respect, you know, for really intelligent scientists. His book here, The Grand Design, came out in 2010. That's only 8 years ago. In the grand design, Hawking said this, quote, because there are laws such as gravity. I just let that sink in for a minute, because who's got an objection? We all know there is gravity, and it works, and it always works. There are laws such as gravity. Now here comes the punchline. The universe can and will create itself from nothing. Now, you're a brilliant scientist, every one of you, right? You've all been to Harvard and Yale and got degrees from both, right? You all are renowned as the smartest people on earth, right? Right? So you can handle his argument here, and you can see why that just must be so, huh? Because Stephen says so, and we're smart as he is. No, when you look at that, you could have, I think, a very significantly lower than average IQ, and he didn't actually have the highest one on record anyway, pretty high. Yeah, there's gravity. Does it then follow that because there's gravity, that a non-existent universe can create itself from nothing? Hardly think so. So, what happened next was the whole scientific world began to wonder about itself and their grand hero. One in particular, John Lennox, the only quote I have, though a lot of people were upset about it, professor of mathematics, University of Oxford, fellow in mathematics and philosophy of science, said, quote, Hawking's argument appears to me even more illogical when he says the existence of gravity means the creation of the universe was inevitable. But how did gravity exist in the first place? Who put it there? And what was the creative force behind its birth? You don't have to be a genius to know that the genius atheist is wrong. And even fellow geniuses, you know, can figure that out, and good for them. Because we can figure that out. Anybody can figure that out. A non-existent thing cannot create itself. That is impossible. And what's so hard to understand? But if you're a Hitchens or a Dawkins or a Hawkins, then that's your life story. Is trying to improve such very, very, trying to prove such very, very improbable things. The question is the chicken or the egg, and you know the answer. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The chicken. Who said so? God. And then they reproduced after their kind. They don't create themselves. Nothing creates itself. Nothing cannot of itself create anything. There had to be an eternal something if there is an anything. There is stuff. Something had to create it. This we know. Hawking's conclusion in another place is, it is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. End quote. How many of you know what touch paper is? I didn't either, but there it is. So if you grew up in England, you'd know this. Touch paper is just a fuse. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going, said Hawking. John Lennox responds, when Hawking argues in support of his theory of spontaneous creation that it was only necessary for the blue touch paper to be lit to set the universe going, the question must be, where did the blue touch paper come from? And who lit it? If not whom? If not God? Now, brother, what I'm doing this morning, and will be doing, you know, for the next several lessons here, is trying to help you to say, okay, I get it. These men are the heroes of the world. They look like real smart guys. A lot of people buy this silliness, and it's a new world for us as Christians. I didn't used to have to teach people that it was more likely that God existed and that you can't get something out of nothing unless an eternal something lights the touch paper. We could figure that out. But we need to be better than that now. We need to be able to answer these kinds of arguments. We need to prepare the soil better. Used to be, we had nice, beautiful bottom land, and we could just go down and plant seed. It was a lot easier then than it is now.
So now there's a lot of rocks, and we're going to have to go out and clean up those fields to begin with. But don't be daunted by this. Don't be discouraged by this. Don't wring your hands and lament, oh, woe is us, because we're not living 100 years ago when it was a whole lot easier. Just dig in and go to work and learn these new sets of responsibilities that we have before God to help people understand that there is a God, to be able to answer definitively this question, does God exist, so that we then can go plant the seeds in soil that we have helped to become more fertile. So I just want to introduce you to a set of arguments that you probably have already heard. Some of these, at least the first one, be very familiar to you. These are what we will think of as the standard philosophical arguments for the existence of God. Now, if you want to be real smart, you know, Dawkins, those kind of guys, then what you do is you use the word teleological. You say, this is the teleological argument. Now, just raise your hand. What is the teleological argument? Does anybody know? I got one. Okay. Well, it's the simplest of all arguments. Design demands a designer. Have you ever heard that phrase before? Yeah, something can't come from nothing. If a thing is complex, obviously it's designed. If there's a design in it, then there must be a designer. So the fancy term is teleological. But it's pretty compelling, brethren, that all things in nature are this way. You cannot have complex organisms, one author says, irreducibly complex. They can't get any less complex to function. They cannot arise out of nothing. Nor can they arise out of an evolutionary process. Design requires a designer. That designer is God. The cosmological argument is also tremendously compelling. It's very, very convincing. It is that space, time, and matter require a prime mover. Just the fact that they exist. It's what we were seeing Maddox argue. You know, who created the paper? Who lit the fuse? But the ontological argument is a little more difficult. I don't care for it much. The fact that I can conceive there is a God requires the existence of a God. I've never been a big proponent of the volitional argument either. That argument is the existence of will. The human beings have a desire to do this or that, and the ability to choose when they have options requires some supreme will. Well, it's a pretty deep philosophical argument. I've studied it, but I never, you know, offer it to people. The aesthetic or aesthetical argument is very closely akin. Relative beauty and truth. What is pretty, what is not, requires some absolute standard. Why do we even think in those terms? That absolute standard would have to do with a God who is the epitome of all such things. And finally, there's a moral argument. In this one, I think you at least want to be able to just ask one question. Where did morals come from? I've had fun with atheists. Tell me how a non-existent thing, which then created itself, went on to achieve self-consciousness, a sense of me as opposed to them, and then formed a structure by which judgments could be made as to whether or not my behavior was right or wrong in relation to their behavior. Where did that come from in the course of evolution? And the evolutionist and the atheist will admit, we do not know. They will. They'll tell you, we don't know. We have no idea where consciousness comes from via the evolutionary processes. We have no idea where morals could possibly arise in an evolutionary process. So out of this long list, these are the classics. The first one, teleological, design. The second one, cosmological, something can't create, or nothing cannot create anything. And then the moral argument, those are really very powerful. You need to do some study on those. You need to spend some time with those. But if I could just get this to turn, what am I doing wrong here? There it is. Going to the next slide. There we go. Okay. All right. I just want to say, brethren, you don't have to go to school for this. And I did. I took a class in philosophy, and I got an A in philosophy, and I wrote papers on this stuff and studied all of this. I did it in a secular school. I had nothing to do with a religious school whatsoever. I was not yet a Christian. I didn't have any axe or to grind or convictions at all. And so went through, looked at all of those kinds of things on my own. Great. But I have to admit that while I do believe there's a sense in which these things should be convincing, it may be that we've made a mistake. It is, they get very deeply into the weeds, you know, quite the depths of philosophical reasoning when you really start chasing after all that, which is why you now see I went so fast over them all. You can really spend a lot of time in there. Maybe we've made mistakes with those arguments. Maybe there's a flaw in our logic or an exception that we're just not aware of. And so frankly, all these years, I've never been a really big fan of those standard arguments. They do convince me. They do compel me to believe there is a God. But I find them difficult and just, you know, not quite so helpful. What we need is something stronger, if you will, and particularly in the light of the culture that we're currently in. You know, I was turning to look, but I realize now I've got it up on the screen. There will be a judgment, brethren, that's going to be based upon this passage, Romans 1, verses 18 through 21. There is then in God's mind something so absolutely powerful that he has the right as an all-just God to pass an eternal judgment on people based on a foundation you see right here. Romans 1:18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. That which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to prepare you for yet another argument for the existence of God that, so far as I know, is never used among us. I like it. See, if you like it, I'm going to put another arrow in your quiver here this morning. But I want you to notice two things about this passage, one of which I think I've overlooked at least. Where did God make known this fact of his existence and his invisible attributes? Within us. And number two, this conviction that is within us comes from the experience of the world that is around us. We as a people in churches of Christ, we got the second part of that, I think, really well. So we said, you know, something cannot come from nothing. Teleological argument, ontological argument. We use those kinds of arguments, rightly so. We are correct in using those arguments. Those arguments are true. They should convince an open and an honest mind. But I'm thinking maybe we were missing the within argument. Because what I'm about to show you is that our existence creates within us a conviction within that I believe is really quite important. So in churches of Christ, I was raised with this, you were all raised with this, it's right that we were raised with this, so you know, don't get upset in the next few minutes, as I say to you. We wear it as a great badge of honor that we are a logical people, that we are not swayed by emotions, that emotions supplant knowledge, and that they will deceive you. And we're right to do so. Jeremiah said, heart's exceedingly wicked. You know, who can know it? So all that's true. It's all true. But perhaps we've taken it maybe just a little bit too far, and absolutely. We do need to just accept, brethren, that feelings and sensations do exist. And if they exist because God created them. And they are surely within you. They are not outside of you. They are within you. They are a very inherent and integral part of your being, these emotions. And woe betide the individual who just wants to throw them all away as if they have no use, excuse me, at all. These feelings are not necessarily wrong. We were right to caution people. Cart before the horse, let your intellect lead, put the emotions in the back, discipline your emotions. If you run off with the emotions, you know, in the harness, and you got your intellect in the back seat, you're going to have problems. All true, all true, all absolutely true. But be careful you don't take those emotions and throw them out of the back seat into the dust of the highway behind you. You know, they do exist. God gave them to you. And what you sense is not necessarily wrong. Now, I'm going to give you a very imperfect, I think, illustration. It'll help you see a second illustration, maybe a little bit more helpful. For a period of 5 years, 8th grade through high school, I was a very ardent surfer, lived on the Southern California coast. This guy named Bruce Irons, I'm not sure if that's his daughter or not. But I want to suggest to you that if I was to go and teach you a course on hydraulics and wave dynamics and explain everything about swimming and paddling, and then, you know, I would hand you, when I was done with my master's degree course of all things logical and intellectual about surfing, and say, here's the board, go for it, how well will you surf? Not at all. What is necessary? You have to go out and feel it. You have to go out and experience it. You have to go out and learn how to do it. I could spend years teaching you how, but the first time you try to stand up on a board, you will not. You just can't get from here to there without some things happening in between. So as Yoda would put it, surf you must. That's the only way. You're going to figure it out. Now, I recognize that is a very physical illustration, and we're talking about God and whether or not there is in existence a being that we cannot see, feel, touch, taste, or smell. You know, we're talking about an intangible being unknown to the senses. So the previous illustration, just get your feet wet. Let me ask you this question. Why do you love your children? Be careful, because emotions are bad. But you love them anyway, don't you? Why do you love them more than anybody else's kids? Why is it relative love? How do you define love? How do you explain it to somebody that has not experienced it? How do you explain it and convict it? Charles Manson, Ted Bundy, Green River Killer, you know, but it exists. It just what? It just is because I know it. Because I feel it. So, what I'd like for you to think about here for just a few minutes this morning, brethren, so the teleology and cosmology and ontology and volition, aesthetics and morality, I think part of the reason all that stuff is taught in the college courses is to pull the wool over people's eyes, see how smart I am. I spent hours studying all this, and I got my degree, you know, in all of this. And they're doing kind of the same thing that we have been doing. They are ignoring and decrying the absolute failure, they think, of anybody who says, but I know there's a God. I just know that there is. This intuitional argument that I'm about to make for just a minute or two, I would like for us at least to add to our arsenal. Because there are certain undeniable realities that whether you're talking to a Hitchens or a Dawkins or a Hawkins, these things that I'm about to show you are true. There has never in the history of humankind been discovered any race, group, culture, people of any kind anywhere that did not believe in something that was intangible and greater than they are. All cultures in all history have always worshipped something. They've been wrong about what to worship, and we were there to teach them how. But they knew they should. Why did they know they should? How did they come to understand this? It is without exception. In cultures, now you have the rare few, very few. They'd like you to think there's a lot of atheists. There's not at all. They inflate the numbers constantly. There is also in the human being a universal need or a desire for God. There is a natural turn of events that when you get in really big trouble, what do? You cry out for help. Everybody does, and they don't even really know why. But you do. Number three, you were made in God's image. That's why I brought up the emotions thing a little while ago. Why do you get mad? Because you are animated by some portion of the Spirit of God that was put into you to make you a living being made in His image, and He gets mad. Why do you know love? Because God is love. The things that we experience because God put within us a measure of His Spirit. He gave us these things. So, brethren, I'm with you 100%. You understand I'm not undoing anything we've ever taught. Emotions must be restrained. They must be understood. They must be disciplined. They must be controlled. All these things are so. But as a people, we threw them out of the boat. And that, I think, was a mistake. So I'm going to continue to develop this thought. Number four, God Himself is in you. This one I'd like to read from Acts chapter 17. In the 17th chapter, verses 22 through 29, Paul stands upon Mars Hill, makes one of the most magnificent philosophical arguments on the home turf of the world's greatest philosophers. He says this, "Midst of the Areopagus, men of Athens, I observe you're very religious in all respects. While I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and all things in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, neither is He served by human hands as though He needed anything, since He Himself gives to all life and breath and all things, and He made from one every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God." Did you see that line? You can't stop yourself. You can't help yourself. You will begin early on seeking God, that they should seek God, if perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him, though He's not far from each one of us, for in Him we live and move and exist. As even some of your own poets have said, we are His offspring. God was in Hitchens. God is in Dawkins. God was in Hawkins. And they fought Him. But they wrestled with a real being. They fought desperately and lost because they wrestled with a more powerful being. But they knew that they were going to have to deal with the innate conviction in the human being that there is a God. Might be very, very improbable for Dawkins, but he spent a lifetime trying to make it more probable. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11, God set eternity in your heart. Why do you not want to die? Because eternity is in your heart. Because God is eternal. Because it is His image, His Spirit, which animates you. Because you are like Him. To that degree, and death is the antithesis of all these things, the biggest fear that there is. Eternity is in you, and the longing to spend it with your God. And then there is this power. How many people would die for Hitchens to have the right to smoke another cigarette, get drunk once more, and abandon his second wife? Not too many people want to die for him. Power, belief in pure God has caused countless numbers of people to go to the grave under the worst kinds of torture because God is and they just know it. Whether they've been to the school to study the teleological, cosmological, volitional, moral, or any other argument, they just know, brethren, that there is God. Now, I'm going over, and I know I am, but I got started late, so I'm claiming my turf here. So let me just say as we wrap this one up. Look, the entire Soviet Union and the Chinese have tried to make atheists out of everybody by force. How well is that working out? They failed utterly. Voltaire, very famous individual, you know, was anti-God in every sense, very famous atheist many years gone by. Today, the United Bible Society owns his house. Belief goes on. Voltaire didn't. So, brethren, think. Like salmon swim upstream. Like birds know where to go in the winter. Like the love that exists in every one of us, and particularly in parents, which God is Father, to children, of which we are. We seek an all Father. So the point of this lesson now, I was 5 minutes late starting, I'll be 5 minutes late ending. But the point of this lesson is this, brethren. You have all the power. You are in the driver's seat. You need not fear any of these men. Their own people in the scientific world will see the flaws in what they do. Those who deny the existence of God and refuse to serve God are doing so against their own natural inclinations. And if they have determined that they will fight what is so evident within them, then wave bye-bye and don't waste your time on them. Keep your pearls to yourself. But know that in the general population of some, 6 billion people on the surface of the earth, brethren, you're already winning because they don't want to deny the undeniable. They simply want an understanding, more input about the God that they just know has got to be out there. They just know. That's because God made it evident within them. And a part of what you learn by looking at the natural world is that you have love, a desire to live forever, and a conviction that certain things are right and other things are wrong. And that whole 6-point list of undeniable facts, brethren, is in every human being. Go get them. Because they are, most of them, longing to know what that truth is. Do not be discouraged. Just go sow your seed in the field that God gave you in this town and in this time. You are second in intelligence, in argumentation, and in truth to no one. Not Hawkins, who died embarrassed. The culmination of his life was a self-contradictory stupidity. It's what he spent his whole life doing. There's gravity, so something can come from nothing. And then he went where? To meet his maker. So will you. Be ready. Thank you.